chapter 38. The witnesses. There were twice 15 this time, went with him as far as Hector Street. They halted at the curb. He crossed the street and went on alone. Piper megaphoned after him, "Maniac, come back! We were just kidding! You don't have to!" Maniac just waved and went on. He knew he should be feeling afraid of these East Enders, these so-called black people, but he wasn't. It was himself he was afraid of any trouble he might cause just by being there. It was the day of the worms, that first almost warm after the rainy night day in April, when you bolt from your house to find yourself in a world of worms. They were as numerous here in the East End as they had been in the West. The sidewalks, the streets, the very places where they didn't belong. Forlorn, marooned on concrete and asphalt. No place to burrow. April's orphans. Once, when he was little in Hollidaysburg, he had gone along with his toy wheelbarrow, carefully lifting them with a wheelbarrowed kitchen fork, carefully lifting them with a borrowed kitchen fork until the barrel was full, then dumped them into Mr. Snavely's compost pile. And sure as the worms followed the rain, the kids followed the worms. West End, East End, they had poured from their houses onto the cool, damp sidewalks. And as if they gave the worms any notice, it was only when they squashed one underfoot. And so Maniac moved through the East End. He felt the presence of not one, but two populations, both occupying the same territory, yet each unmindful of the other. One yelping and playing and chasing and laughing, the other lost and silent and dying by the millions. "Yo, fish belly!" Maniac snapped to. He glanced at a street sign. He was four blocks from Hector, deep in the East. Mars Bar came dip-jiving toward him, taller than before, bigger, but still scowling. "Hey, fish! Thought you was gone!" Maniac turned to face him fully. Mars Bar did not stop till he was inside Maniac's phone booth of space, inches from his face. They locked eyes, levelly. Maniac thinking, "I must be growing, too." He said, "I'm back." The scowl fierced. "Maybe nobody told you. I'm better than ever. I'm getting better every day. I'm almost afraid to wake up in the morning." He leaned in closer. "'Cause of how bad I might have got overnight." Maniac smiled, nodded. "Yep, you're bad, Mars." He gave a sniff. A smile went a little smirky. "And I'm getting so bad myself, I think I must be half black." Mars' eyes bulged. He backed off. The scowl collapsed, and he howled with laughter. His buddies, who were hanging back, stared dumbly. As Mars unwounded from his laughing fit, he studied Maniac up and down, aware, too, that Maniac was studying him. When he could speak again, he said, "Still them raggedy clothes, eh, fish?" He lifted one foot, posed. "I seen you looking, like them kicks. Just got 'em?" Maniac nodded. "Nice." They were nice. They were beautiful. The best. Yes, the baddest. Sneaks he had ever seen. Way better than anything Grayson could have afforded. "I forgot to tell you something else, too, fish."
"What's that?"
I'm faster. I've been working out. Got my new boss kicks." He sprinted in place, arms and legs positioning to a blur. He stopped. He jabbed a finger at Maniac's nose, pressed it, flattening the soft end of it. "See? Guess you were right. Now at least you got a black nose." He laughed. They both laughed. Everybody laughed. Then Mars turned scowly again, saying, "But you ain't black enough or bad enough to beat the Mars man. We gonna race, hunky donkey. The race was set up on Plum Street, the long, level block between Ash and Jackson. By the time they were ready, half the kids in the East End were there, from the tiniest pipsqueaks to high schoolers. The little kids ran races of their own from curb to curb. The bigger kids shouldered blasters and dug into their jeans for coins to bet with. For the first time since last fall, mothers opened windows and leaned out from second stories. Traffic was detoured from both ends of the block. No one could find string for the finish, so a second-story mother dropped down a spool of bright pink thread. Another problem was the start. First, they had to find chalk to draw the starting line. When they did, nobody could seem to draw it straight. The result? A stack of starting lines creeping up the street till someone brought out a yardstick and did it right. The next problem came when the stranger, Bump Gilliam, who was also Mars Bar's best pal, called, "Get ready!" And someone in the crowd yelled, "That ain't what you say! You say, take your mark!" Well, everybody jumped into it then. There was shoving and jawing and almost a fist fight over the proper way to start a race. Finally, there was a compromise, and Bump called, "Get ready! On your mark!" At which point, someone else called, "Go, Mars!" And Bump turned and snarled, "Shut up! When the starter starts, there's no noise!" So naturally, someone else called, "Smoke 'em, Mars!" And then came, "Waste 'em, Mars!" And, "Do the honk, barman!" And they might still be calling to this day, had not a single voice separated itself from the others. "Burn 'em, McGee!" It was hands down, laughing and pointing from his perch on the roof of a car. Bump jumped into the let-up. "Get set! Go!" And at long last, mossy from their weight at the starting line, they went. Even as the race began, even after it began, Maniac wasn't sure how to run it. Naturally, he wanted to win, or at least to do his best. All his instincts told him that. But there were other considerations: whom he was racing against, and where, and what the consequences might be if he won. These were heavy considerations, heavy enough to slow him down, until the hysterical crowd and the sight of Mars Bar's sneaker bottoms and the boiling of his own blood ignited his afterburners. And before you could say, "Burn 'em, McGee," he was ahead, the pink thread bobbing in his sights. But he never saw his body break the thread. He saw only the face of Mars Bar, straining, gasping, unbelieving, losing. They went crazy. They went wild. They went totally bananas. "You see him? He turned around. He ran backwards. He did it backwards. He beat him going backwards." Mars Bar tried. He shoved Bump. "You started too fast. I wasn't ready." He shoved the thread holders. "You moved it up so he could win. I was gaining on him." He shoved Maniac. "You bumped me. You got a false start. You cheated." But his protest drowned in the pandemonium. "Why did I do it?" was all Maniac could think. He hadn't even realized it till he crossed the line, and he regretted it instantly. Wasn't it enough just to win? Did he have to disgrace his opponent as well? Had he done it deliberately to pay Mars Bar for all his nastiness? To pay back Mars Bars for all his nastiness? To show him up and shut him up once and for all? His only recollection was a feeling of sheer, joyful exuberance, himself in celebration, shouting, "Amen!" in the Bethany Church, bashing John McNabb's fastballs out of sight, dancing the polka with Grayson. Maybe it was that simple. After all, who asks why otters toboggan down mud banks? but that didn't make it any less stupid or rotten a thing to do. The hatred in Mars Bar's eyes was no longer for a white kid in the East End. It was for Jeffrey McGee, period. The crowd surged with him as he made his way westward. It wasn't clear whether they were glad or not that he had won, only that they had seen something to set them off. They jostled and jabbed and high-fived and jived. For everyone who called him White Lightning, two more challenged him to race. Right here, baby, you and me. See who gonna turn his back on who? Maniac kept moving, embarrassed, wishing he could just break out and sprint for the West End, wishing he could duck into the Beale's house and be sanctuaried there and not fear reprisals on them. And just about then, miraculously, two little hands were worming into his. Two familiar voices squealing, "Maniac! Maniac!" Hester and Lester. He snatched them up, one in each arm. He was on Sycamore Street. There was the house, the door opening, Amanda, Mrs. Beale smiling to beat the band. Chapter 39. During the night, March doubled back and grabbed April by the scruff of the neck and flung it another week or two down the road. When Maniac slipped silently from the house at dawn, the only way he'd ever managed to get away, March pounced with cold and nasty paws. But Maniac wasn't minding. The reunion had been ecstatic and tearful and nonstop happy, and inside he was pure July. He was a half a block up Sycamore before he stopped tiptoeing. Minutes later, he crossed Hector. The streets were dry. An occasional scrap of chewed rawhide was all that remained of the worms. Hours later, Russell and Piper spotted him three blocks off. "Maniac, you're alive! We thought they got ya! We thought they slit your throat! We thought they strangled ya and pulled your tongue out! We thought they chopped your head off and boiled ya! Yeah, boiled ya! And drunk your blood! Yeah! And drunk your brains! You don't drink brains, you moron meatball! Yeah, you do! Brains are like milkshakes, like Dairy Queen. You can drink them with a straw. You can hear them sloshing if you shake your head hard enough. Listen! Hey, get off my head! Hey, help! They were off and running. Maniac couldn't help laughing. In spite of their twisted, ludicrous impressions of East Enders, the concern and the tears in their eyes had been genuine. They had really missed him. They had really been afraid for him. Two houses away, he could hear the thump, almost feel it, and Father George McNabb's voice. "Lay 'em down easy." "I said easy." Followed by son John, "This easy enough?" Thump! Followed by a string of curses from George McNabb that fried the cold morning like an egg. The living room was hazy with dust. At the back end of the dining room, they were bringing in the cinder blocks. George and John and a handful of cobras, lugging and grunting them in from the backyard and dumping them onto the floor. Thump! Thump! "Hey, kid!" George McNabb was pointing through the haze. 3 months, and he still didn't know his tenant's name. "Get your lily hide over here. Start lugging these." Maniac waved. "Later, gotta go." He shut the door and headed up the street. So they were really doing it. He had heard them planning it for weeks, making drawings, buying or stealing cement, trowels, a level, a pillbox, they called it. Once it was done, they'd be ready. Let the revolt begin. Let the rebels, as they called the East Enders, come. Let them bust through the newly installed bars over the plywood on the windows. Let them bust through the steel door. They'll find themselves staring down the barrel of a little surprise. They squabbled over what surprise should be. Uzi, AK-47, bazooka. Why? Maniac had asked Giant John one day. Why what? Why are you doing all this? To get ready. What else? Well, what do you think's going to happen? What's gonna happen? Giant John swatted a squad of roaches from the kitchen table and sat down. What's gonna happen is, one of these days, they're gonna revolt. Who says? Who care who says? You think they're gonna make an announcement? Maniac tried to picture Amanda and Hester and Lester and Bow Wow storming the barricades. When's all this supposed to happen? John shrugged. You never know. Maybe this summer. He jumped up, grabbed a beer from the fridge, flipped it open. They like to revolt in the summer. Makes them itchy. They like to overrun the cities. This time, we'll be ready. And he told Maniac what he often imagined lying in bed. The blacks sweeping across Hector. One steaming summer night. Torches, chains, blades, guns, war cries. Marauding, looting, overrunning the West End. Climbing in through smashed windows, doors, looking for whites. Bloodthirsty for whites. Like Indians in the old days. Indians on a raid. That's what they are. Giant John nodded thoughtfully. Today's Indians. The cockroach strolling up his pant leg wasn't the only thing making Maniac feel crawly. He shook off the roach. He moved to the center of the kitchen to surround himself with as much space as possible. But other people, he said. I don't hear them talking about revolts. Nobody else wants to make a pillbox. Giant John tilted the last of his beer into his mouth. Maybe when we do, he grinned, they will. That had been weeks before, and now the pillbox was underway, no longer an idea in the backyard, but a reality in the dining room. Now there was no room that Maniac could stand in the middle of and feel clean. Now there was something else in that house, and it smelled worse than garbage and turds. Chapter 40. He ran far that day, away from the town, letting the wind wash him. When he returned to the West End, he heard in the distance Mrs. Pickwell whistling her children to dinner. Though he had heard the whistle many times, he had not answered it since his first day in town. Now he felt, as he had that day, that it was meant for him. This time, of course, there was a difference. He was no stranger. He was Maniac McGee, the kid who had walked barefoot through the dump near their house. The Pickwell kids cheered when he showed up and treated him like a legend in the flesh. Mrs. Pickwell did better. She treated him like a member of the family, as if she would have been surprised if he hadn't come on the whistle. Nor was Maniac the only visitor for dinner. Mr. Pickwell had brought home a down-and-out shoe salesman in sore need of sympathy and a good meal. As Maniac ate and talked and laughed his way through dinner, he couldn't help thinking of the Beals, how alike the two families were, friendly, giving, accepting. So easily, he could picture the Beals' brown faces around this dinner table, and the little Pickwell kids' white bodies in the bathtub at 728 Sycamore. Whoever had made of Hector Street a barrier, it was surely not these people. Fortified by his good times at the Pickwells, Maniac returned to the McNabs. After the East End scare, Russell and Piper no longer demanded stunts of him in return for attending school. On the one hand, this was a relief to Maniac. On the other, it left him with this less influence over them. He could always extort a day or two in class from them with the free weekly pizza. Beyond that, he goaded them towards school any way he could. He organized a marbles tournament that could take place only in the schoolyard during recess. He tried reading to them, as he had to Hester and Lester and to Grayson, but they paid as much attention as the roaches. He took them to the library, then scrapped that idea after their shenanigans left the librarian blubbering and blue-faced. Then May arrived with its warm weather and blew away what little power he had left. The boys began again to dream of travel. Wood appeared in the backyard. They were building a raft. "Gonna sail down the river to the ocean," they said. One day he heard frenzied horn honking and screaming. He turned to see an ancient rusty gas hog convertible rolling by, with Russell behind the wheel and Piper jumping up and down and shrieking in the back seat. By the time Maniac caught up, they were gone and the car was shuddering against a telephone pole. Another time, he had to run them down and haul them back to Dorsey's grocery, where he made them empty their bulging pockets of the 50 bubble gums they had stolen. It was a maddening, chaotic time for Maniac. Running in the mornings and reading in the afternoons gave him just enough stability to endure the zany nights at the McNabb's. When he asked himself why he couldn't just drop them, the answer was never clear. It wasn't so much that he wanted to stay as that he couldn't go. In some vague way, to abandon the McNabb boys would be to abandon something in himself. He couldn't shake the suspicion that deep inside, Russell and Piper McNabb, in the prayer dark seed of their kidhoods, they were identical to Hester and Lester Beale. But they were spoiling, rotting from the inside, like a pair of peaches in the sun. Soon, unless somebody did something, the rot would reach the pit. And yet he held back. Oh, he prodded and persuaded and inspired and bribed the boys to do right, but he never forced them, never commanded, never shouted, because to do so would be parental, and he was not yet ready for that. How could he act as a father to these boys when he himself ached to be somebody's son? But then one day the boys went too far. He found them playing with the old glove Grayson had given him for Christmas. As if that weren't bad enough, they were using it as a football, punting it back and forth. Maniac exploded. He popped off for a good 10 minutes, got it all out. This was the last straw, he told them. From now on, it was gonna be different. No more Mr. Nice Guy. When I say jump, you say how high. Got it? They got it. For the first time in their lives, the boys were speechless. Speechless as they did their homework that night. Speechless as they went to bed at 9 o'clock. Speechless as they went off to school next morning. The piece lasted 3 days. Shock accounted for the first day. The second and third days were a new game called obedience, or being good. When the game lost its appeal, Maniac lost his power. He told them to sit. They stood. He told them to stand. They sat. Instead of going to school, they worked on their raft. Instead of doing homework, they played war in the pillbox. They brought their plastic weapons down from the hole and stationed themselves at the two small gunnery slots in the cinder block wall and blasted away at anyone moving through the house, not to mention imaginary rebels streaming through the door and over the window seals. Stop! Maniac finally yelled and snatched the two red gun barrels protruding from the slots. In a moment, two more barrels appeared. Stop! He commanded. Ain't shooting you, Russell whined. We're shooting them rebels. Bam, bam, bam. Pow! Got one. Pow! Bam! Got another. Bam, bam. I said stop! Maniac grabbed the guns, threw them on the floor, and stomped on them. He didn't stop till they were plastic splinters. The only sound was that of the turtle scratching somewhere in the room. The gunnery slots framed the boys' dumbstruck faces. Russell was the first to speak. Get out of my house! Yeah, sneered Piper. Outta here. Maniac went upstairs, got his satchel, and was gone. That night and the next night, he slept at the park. The following day, as he sat reading in the library, In came the McNabb boys. They rushed to him. Hey, Maniac, blurted Piper. We've been looking all over for you. You gotta come to my birthday party. I'm having a party tomorrow. What do you say, huh? You coming, huh? Maniac couldn't believe it. The ugly feelings of the other day showed nowhere on their excited faces. Come on, Maniac. You gotta. And just like that, as he stared at them, the idea came. An idea as zany as they were. The words seemed to lift right off their faces, like sunburnt skin peeling. Well, okay, he said, on one condition. What's that? If I can bring somebody with me. Sure, bring everybody. We're gonna party. The librarian edged closer to the phone.